I've kind of implied, but really haven't said directly, so I'm going to say it now. We went from general depressants, or at least substances that we call generally depressing, and the other title was non-selective. And then we kind of slid from general to selective, or more specific agents, when we started talking about anxiolytics, that is, anti-anxiety. You guys can speak down here. Okay. Anti-anxiety agents. When we went to the benzodiazepines, I just kind of briefly threw in methylbamate, which was the prototypical and most widely used carbamate anti-anxiety agent. I said it wasn't so much anti-anxiety as it was muscle relaxing. Talked a little bit about hydroxyzine, which is more of a specialized situation that we use pre-op. But basically, our anxiolytic drugs now are the benzodiazepine types of agents. But with that, we kind of went from the general type of sedative hypnotic, which is more dose-response related for its anxiolytic activity, to a more selective situation. And you might just read that more selective because it's more specific. The whole idea of benzodiazepine receptors being a part of the GABA-A receptor. But at least it got us out of the generalized into the more selective types of agents. And that's where we're going to spend the bulk of the rest of the semester. We might get into the general stimulants if we have time at the end of the semester, things like amphetamine and the ADHD drugs. But for the most part, now we're going to be spending our time over here. We've talked about anxiolytics. The next topic that we're going to mention at this point is epilepsy, the anti-epileptics. And before we start talking about anti-epileptic drugs, I have to say a few things about epilepsy as a condition or a pathology or a disease, however you want to term it. And on the handout, probably the first page or at least half a page, kind of outlines the general comments that I want to emphasize. First of all, and I've said this before, I'll say it again just to reemphasize it, the terms anti-epileptic and anti-convulsant are not synonymous. In fact, there are a number of different convulsive etiologies. Among them, intracranial tumors, either benign or malignant. You might also put in here damage. You know, you hit your head against a wall after your test. The physical trauma, the physical damage may in fact induce epilepsy. Kidney issues, uremia, that is the waste products in the blood, basically as a result of kidney problems, may in fact eventually induce epilepsy, convulsions. Drug toxicity very commonly results in convulsions. And anoxia of one sort or another. Sometimes the anoxia is secondary to drugs, other times it's due to other issues, but it may produce convulsions. But what we're going to be talking about today are those convulsions. Did that just come up? Replace the lamp? Been there? Okay. Convulsions due to that condition known as epilepsy. Now, epilepsy is a term very much like cancer. When I say the word cancer, I have kind of under an umbrella put together of about 105 to 110 different diseases. When I use the word epilepsy, I'm not that many, but generally in the high 20s, low 30s in terms of diseases or pathologies. So like cancer, we're delineating a group of disorders. And the byline here, the take-home point is, just like with cancer, therapy for a particular epilepsy is just that. Therapy for a particular epilepsy. So proper therapy, effective therapy, depends upon what? A correct diagnosis. I say you've got epilepsy. You say, what kind of epilepsy is it? That's the first question. Okay? It's a symptom complex, that term. It's not a specific disease, okay? And as you'll note at the top of the paper, okay, that symptom complex depends upon there being transient periodic episodes. That's number one. That's uniform through all types of epilepsy. Okay? Periodic transient episodes. Now, the form of epilepsy that you have may have one or more of the following as part of this periodic, transient, episodic condition. Most commonly, an alteration in the state of consciousness. Now, some textbooks will suggest, no, they won't suggest, they'll state it, that this is a uniform part of epilepsy as well. That every type of epilepsy has an alteration in the state of consciousness. So some books, some authorities in the area will say periodic transient episodes hallmarked by an alteration in the state of consciousness. Now, the problem becomes that in some forms of epilepsy, that alteration may in fact be fractions of a second. So the question is one of time, whether that appears in every form or not. I choose to say no, but that's just my personal preference. Like I say, there are a lot of authorities that would suggest just the opposite. Okay? So understand that. In most forms of epilepsy, there's going to be problems with consciousness. Notice, what is the word alteration? It's not necessarily unconsciousness. That isn't the alteration necessarily. That also is common, but not always. Okay? There will be in a number of different epileptic forms as part of this periodic transient episode convulsive movements. Now, convulsive movements, maybe you got told in physiology, but I'll go over it again, come in two varieties. There are two flavors of convulsions. Flavor one, yeah, right, two flavors of convulsions. It's Monday, and I'm old. Screw it. I'll tell you about it Wednesday after I remember it when I'm asleep tonight. Now I'm going to screw up the whole rest of the lecture trying to remember what the hell I'm supposed to say here. Two types of, we'll get on beyond that, two types of convulsions. Oh. I'm sorry, the coffee just kicked in. Okay. Two types of convulsions. tonic. Tonic convulsion, that term indicates that every voluntary striated muscle in the body is constricted as much as it can, right now. All together, all synchronous. And in the human, when there are tonic convulsions, because of our posture and the fact that we are upright, it is the It is the extensor muscles that are predominant. So when we have a tonic convulsion, we look like we're making a perfect swan dive. You know, hit the water in a nice straight line, no splash. Everything extended. Even the toes pointed, you know, the old tennis gymnastics. On the other hand, we have clonic convulsions. Here, these striated or voluntary muscles are constricting spasmodically. There is no uniformity, and as a result, we get a flailing, if you will, of the extremities. So that may or may not occur as part of these periodic transient episodes. There is often, as opposed to convulsions, a loss of muscular tone. There may be a flaccidity of the striated or voluntary muscles as opposed to convulsions and constrictions. And then the fourth thing you'll notice on the handout that I've got is that often there will be a feeling, a disturbance of feeling, a feeling alteration, or maybe a behavioral abnormality or alteration as part of the as part of the epileptic episode. Epilepsy. About 30-some different conditions, all of them with one or the other of these issues or problems. So what is it that we think is the issue? Well, for about the last 30, 35 years, most of the people in this area would suggest that here's the problem. As the CNS is put together, and of course we had to do a lot of experimental work in terms of particularly human CNS physiology and anatomy, as the CNS is put together, one of the things we've learned about it is that it exists normally with a lot of controls. There are a lot of brakes, a lot of controls placed on the central nervous system. These controls occur both intercellularly between neurons, generally in the form of iPSPs and the GABA types of receptors that we've already talked about, intercellular controls, and there are also some intracellular controls, that is, the cell holds itself back a little bit. Epilepsy is thought to occur when, for one reason or another, either a neuron or a small group of neurons breaks free from these controls and becomes what we call a focus. We talk about an epileptogenic focus. Or in the plural, foci. But generally speaking, we're talking about a single focus. Okay? So it's like then freshmen in college getting away from the parents rules there were back at home on behavior and saying, let's get crazy. Okay? You're in the door, we're in class, and somebody says, hey, let's go to Schubert's. Or Schubert's or whatever. The sawmill. I know them all. The gate. Now, the question is, who is it that says that? Translate that into, where is that particular focus located in the CNS? Is it in a cerebral area, cerebral motor area, cerebral sensory area? Where is that focus? And question two is, when you say, let's go to the bar, how many of your colleagues can you convince to go along with you? How many know what the animal called a lemming is? Take the lemmings all over the cliff. You know, let's go get crazy, the whole class goes. You know, Dr. Holt says, I'll buy, the whole class goes. Okay, how many can you take with you? How much of a spread is there in the abnormal activity? Because what happens is when this focus loses, it's uncontrollable, the controls are lost, it starts firing in an abnormally fast and erratic pattern. And this normal, this abnormal, erratic, quick firing pattern then can spread over a great area of the brain, or it can remain rather localized. And so in general then, we have two general categories of epilepsy. Generalized forms, where the focus can take everybody over the edge. And I'll just put in parentheses here that most often in a generalized form, okay, the question becomes, can the focus get to the thalamus? If the thalamus becomes involved, that tends to be like the hub airport. Because once that gets involved, it's easy to spread it all over. Generalized form, or it can stay rather localized. That is, the intercellular controls are strong enough to keep it rather just in one area. So we have generalized forms and localized forms of epilepsy. The problem then becomes, once that epileptic focus is established, it becomes relatively easy. I'm sorry, I think we've lost the screen. It becomes relatively easy for things to either stimulate the focus itself or make it easier for focal activity to spread. And since the green doesn't show up very well and we don't have the screen, I'll just go down through. Alterations in plasma pH. Generally due to metabolic issues that you're learning about in biochem. Alterations in plasma pH. Is this on your handout too, by the way? For what?
Yeah.
Okay. Alterations in blood glucose. And this tends to be a biggie. Guess what type of epileptic is extremely hard to control? A diabetic epileptic is a goddamn nightmare. Usual. Changes in fluid osmolarity or osmolality, ionic issues. You become hypokalemic or something like that, you've got an issue. Changes or variations in hormonal balance. What does this say about female versus male epileptics? Your age. This should tend to be more complex with the female. Okay. Changes in hormonal balance. Other hormonal issues. Adrenal hormones can come into play. Epinephrine and adrenal medullary release is a biggie. Those types of things. Stress, if you will. Physical or chemical trauma. Okay, now what do we mean by that? Temperature issues. You go out in a real cold day or you go out in a real hot day, and body temperature regulation can trigger epileptic seizures. Chemical trauma, drugs added to the regimen even can be an issue. Nutritional changes can be an issue. Cerebrovascular disorders, problems with blood flow, and of course that gets back to oxygenation and plasma pH and ionic equilibrium and all of that sort of stuff. And I've already talked about stress, but emotional issues can trigger epileptic seizures as well. So you can see a person that has an epileptic focus is in a very vulnerable state. And can induce that person's particular or individual form of epilepsy. Now, at this point, let me just make a couple of general comments. As pharmacists, in using chemicals to deal with this epileptic focus, basically, at least from a historic perspective, and I'll talk a little bit about suspected mechanisms of action in a couple of days, but from a historical perspective, our efficacy of treating epilepsy has depended upon our ability to depress this abnormal hyperfocal activity with minimal effect on normal high-speed neuronal firing. There are some neuronal issues, particularly issues with things like coordination. And you can read that as a subtext. Speech is a biggie with coordination. But running or jumping or any type of muscular coordination, just standing and the muscles being able to, those types of high-speed firing things, we do not want to adversely impact while we are dealing with this abnormal high-speed epileptic focus. So we want to try and either depress the focus from firing initially, or if we can't do that, at least depress the ability to spread that activity. Okay, so when the person decides, let's go to the bar, we would like to slap duct tape over their mouth. Say, okay, you can go to the bar, just don't take the rest of us along for the ride. That's what we want to do. And we're going to try and do it chemically. Now, for the record, then, are we curing the epilepsy? No, we are not. We are trying to control it. And a big thing is maximal control with minimal toxicity. Because most of our classic anti-epileptic drugs have a therapeutic index somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 to 4. Very low. And I'm not talking CNS toxicities necessarily, but most of them have a fairly low therapeutic index. Because we want maximum control, maximum effect in terms of controlling epilepsy with minimal toxic issues. All right? Now, for the record, then, we do have cures. One of my good friends in town very commonly, epilepsy tends a lot of the time to develop in and around puberty. Just prior to puberty, he developed epilepsy, a rather serious epileptic seizure pattern. Okay? He's now probably 53, somewhere in there, okay? He had this epilepsy for 30 years, 35 years, all sorts of different chemical patterns, and Dr. Boncher says she's talking about epilepsy, right?
Okay.
So you know a lot of the drugs probably now I'm going to be talking about. He tried all sorts of combinations, polypharmacy, individual drugs, didn't really cure him, control him to some degree, but he couldn't work, okay? Tended to be kind of, I won't say a hermit, but, you know, getting into situations like going to church or going to a concert or something like that, he tended to shy away from that because of the stigma. Okay, everybody with me so far? Well, about 5 years ago now, he went down to Ann Arbor and he said, we found where the focus is. We think we can cure your epilepsy. So he said, that's great with me. So they opened up his skull, put in a couple of probes, and they froze the focus. Another way you can do it was laser therapy. But they froze it, destroyed the neurons. Okay, put his skull back on, said have a good life. He went home, right? Are you with me now? Couple of problems. Since he no longer has epilepsy, he no longer gets disability payments. What does that mean? He had to get a job. The job he got was in Green City. What does that mean?
Go quick.
Get a driver's license. I knew what kind of car he drove. I tended to give it wide berth for about the first 2 or 3 months. He was cured, okay? So, I have some residual effects from all of the chemicals that he took and some other things. In terms of having epileptic seizures, he's been good now for 4 or 5 years. He's had one or maybe two in that period of time. So we do have cures that are not drug-related, because the best we can do with drugs is control. Just understand, okay? We are not killing the focus. We're not targeting it with certain chemicals. Next comment. The thing about the drugs that we're going to be talking about is that they are drugs that can inhibit either the generation or the spread of seizure activity without having maximal side effects on normal high-speed activity. I've said that before. I'm going to turn it around. There are a number of agents that can be considered anti-epileptic. All of the generalized CNS depressants that we've talked about are anti-epileptic. All of the general anesthetics are anti-epileptic. all of the barbiturates can be considered anti-epileptic. The issue is, how do we get to anti-epileptic doses? We essentially knock a person out. We anesthetize them. They don't have any epileptic seizures, but also they don't have any quality of life. They're sleeping. So, but the moral, the point is, in a pinch, in an emergency, desert island with no anti-epileptic medication on the individual because it was lost in the plane crash, you have alternatives that can be used to control the epilepsy. In addition to what we talked about, a number of the antipsychotics will qualify, and some other things, okay? So, yeah, there are a number of things that are anti-epileptic. What we're going to be talking about here are anti-epileptics that have minimal issues, okay? Now, next point. Like a number of CNS conditions, the problem that we've had historically with developing chemicals that we could consider as adequate anti-epileptic drugs is that epilepsy tends to be a condition associated with the human. We can develop epilepsy in a number of other higher apes. And there is some evidence that there is one species of, I don't remember, orangutan or something like that, that may in fact in the wild have epilepsy. But most of the time when we say epilepsy, we're talking about humans. Okay? In a natural state. So in terms of developing drugs, we have either one of two choices. We have either one, getting consent and doing drug trials right off the bat in human, or we can develop animal models. And the animal models that we developed were rather crude, to say the least. Okay? The two major forms of epilepsy are both generalized forms. One of them is known as Grandmal. And the other one is known as Petit Mal. Okay? And I put them in the handout for you in terms of characteristics in that. The name kind of gives you an implication, doesn't it? Mal means kind of seizure or event is more close definition. Okay? So the periodic transient episode is either grand or it's small. We're either plus size or petite. Okay, grand or petit mal. I forget, I'll look it up by Wednesday. I think it's somewhere around 70% of seizure activity is grand mal, and about another 5 to 10% is petit mal. Those may be high, but you get the idea. I mean, we're talking 30 forms, and 3/4 to 4/5 of them are probably one of these two. Okay. And so what it is that we put together for these is this. For grand mal, what we discovered rather early on and what we used as our screening technique is a condition known as maximal electroshock. Okay? And it's all capital letters. In opposition to that, Patimol is minimal electroshock, all small case, or sometimes we would use hemoshock. As our screening technique. Here's maximal electroshock. Rash. We would put clips on the ears after we wet them down with saline. Clip across each ear to a battery or a generating device, and then there were charts developed. As a matter of fact, there's a little soft cover book. Not only did we have these figures for different strains of rats, but also guinea pigs, mice, dogs, cats. Okay? You turn on the electricity, and we would know maximal, kind of gives you the idea, just how much electricity we could generate between those two ears without killing the animal. And so you turn on that juice, and immediately what you would get is extension. Just like in a human, everything would extend. Extensors of the legs would go pouring. Tail would go out straight. What would be the end point is, do the back legs get fully extended? Full hind leg extension. Would be the tonic part of a ground mal seizure, like it shows on your sheet. And then there would be a period of flailing about as it went into a clonic, and then the test would be over. Now, you would take the chemical that you were screening, put it into the animal, and repeat the process probably 2 or 3 days later, give all the nerves a chance to get all the ions back where they should be. Okay, use the same animal, put the drug in, and the end point was, if you could not produce hind leg extension, the drug was considered a possibility for grand mal. If hind leg extension was still there, it obviously wasn't doing anything for us. That was our screening test. In opposition to that, we had minimal electroshock, where we would put, this isn't supposed to be rat, it's supposed to be bad, where we would put just the minimum amount of electricity into the animal to get all of the limbs flailing in a clonic condition. And it was through trial and error discovered that drugs that could stop this flailing with minimal electroshock were effective against Patimol. So that was our screening technique. And a number of the different drugs that I'm going to talk about were developed in this way. I went to a set of meetings when I was in graduate school in the mid-70s out on the West Coast, where one of the big things in those meetings was a presentation by some professors from the veterinary school at Cal Davis that said, we have developed a strain of, I think it was baboons, that we can induce epileptic seizures in through light flashes. And he said, oh, great, we don't have to torture animals anymore. Okay, just use light. Well, what's the issue there? You don't call up to the animal room and say, I want 30 baboons for an experiment. I mean, that, you know, think about the economic implications. At least it was a start. We thought maybe, well, baboons today, rats tomorrow, we can do it. Well, it didn't work out that way, unfortunately. But that was a big thing, to get away from this maximal minimal electroshock type of issue. Another thing that was discovered in the early 80s was that if you remove a piece of the skull and paint on heavy metals, certain heavy metals, when applied to the surface of the brain in a certain area, will induce an epileptic seizure. And so that was another screening technique that was fairly short-lived, by the way. But the two main ones were the electric techniques. But it gets me to another thing. One of the reasons I do this particular section, when I was a junior in high school, I started to develop really severe unilateral on the left-hand side occipital headaches. Unbelievable pain, stabbing pain. And these occurred until probably 3 or 4 years. I still had them when I was working as a pharmacist, to be honest with you. 3 or 4 years after that, but I spent about 2 years in real distress. I was distressed until they gave me the narcotics and the dose. That felt pretty good. But finally, they sent me to a neurologist who did some EEG and other work and said, I'm not really sure, he said, but I think we're going to try phenytoin. And so I took phenytoin for about 5 or 6 years off and on, and it did wonders for these headaches. The bad part was I had still had them to some degree, and I had was taking this medication. The good point was when I went for my induction physical, I got all the way through it. He said, what drugs are you taking? And I said, phenytoin. He said, do you have epilepsy? And I said, no. And they said, yes, you do. You're taking phenytoin. 4F. They threw me out. So I said, okay, if you don't want me, I'll go back to being a pharmacist. But don't go to Vietnam. Go back to being a pharmacist. But I had these. Now, we're going to fast forward to early 1980s. And my oldest daughter developed a syndrome where she would wake up in the middle of the night, usually about 1 or 2 in the morning, violent nausea. She would have 2, 3, maybe 4 really strong emetic episodes. The third and fourth one usually being some pretty dry heaves. She was 4 or 5 at the time. And afterwards, she'd go into deep sleep that we couldn't really get her out of until about noon or 2 o'clock the next day. And these would happen periodically, spasmodically. And after about 6 months to a year of this, we went to, you guessed it, a neurologist. The neurologist said, we don't know, but let's try phenytoin, juvenile form. She started taking it. Actually, before that, they said, they thought it was food allergy for a long time. Well, kind of charred. what's going on in her head, in Reddit diary. And so we charted it out, and to put her on Ventolin, we discovered that these episodes occurred either one after we had been on the water in the summertime, or two after we had been skiing in the winter. Okay, what's the connection? I'm sorry? Any idea? Shimmering light, either off of the water or off of the snow. A form of epilepsy is known as photo-induced epilepsy. First noticed when TVs were produced in the late 40s, early 50s. Because, you know, a TV is nothing but a dot going across the screen at high speed in an analog situation. And the frequency that occurs was different in the United States than in Europe. So Europeans would come to this country, start watching TV, and have a seizure and vice versa. So we first noticed it then, but we really noticed it, okay? You know John Travolta, right? What did we have in every dance hall at that point in time? The ball, right? Incidence of epilepsy went up rather markedly. People that had been dancing the night before had a seizure the day after. Photo-induced epilepsy. There are all sorts of ways in which an epileptic seizure can be induced, not just electricity across the ears. Okay. With that, I'll close for today.